This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They're trying right now as we speak to do upcoming measles, polio, vitamin A and nutrition campaigns. Remembering it's not just a lack of food that kills under fives. It's other diseases, water, and sanitation.
That's UNICEF spokesman James Elder on how aid workers are fighting threats to children from hunger and diseases in Ethiopia's troubled Tigray region. Details coming up. Also, Zambia's former president Kenneth Kaunda's health is improving. A suicide bomber blows himself up in an army camp in Somalia. And Gambia deploys its National Guard on the streets to fight crime. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The UN Children's Fund warns at least 33,000 severely malnourished children in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region face imminent death if they do not receive immediate help to treat their condition. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF is appealing to the Ethiopian government to live up to its promise of unimpeded access to conflict-ridden Tigray province. Agency spokesman James Elder warns this man-made disaster will have unimaginably tragic consequences for thousands of children if aid agencies are unable to reach them.
And incredulously, things can actually deteriorate further for children as food insecurity is expected to worsen over the coming months. So we risk many more deaths than the 33,000 that we fear if crops cannot be planted. So it's imperative that parties to the conflict ensure humanitarian actors, including UNICEF, have unimpeded and safe access on the ground to stave off widespread famine.
UNICEF reports at least 140,000 people in Tigray are facing famine-like conditions. Amid this crisis, it projects some 56,000 children will need treatment for severe acute malnutrition. This, it notes, is almost six times higher than the average annual caseload for the region. Elder says helping these children will be difficult. He says the warring parties have inflicted extensive damage to essential systems and services on which children depend for their survival. He says health facilities have been looted or damaged, and water infrastructure has been destroyed, causing safe drinking water to be in short supply. This, he warns, could lead to outbreaks of disease, putting malnourished children at even greater risk of dying. He says health workers have been attacked and harassed, discouraging many from returning to work.
Mobile health and nutrition teams need to be able to do their job safely. They're trying right now as we speak to do upcoming measles, polio, vitamin A and nutrition campaigns. Remembering it's not just a lack of food that kills under fives, it's other diseases, water and sanitation.
UNICEF is calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities so children can safely receive the life-saving services they need to begin to rebuild their lives. It says it also needs the cash to be able to fund these services. The UN Children's Agency says it is $13 million short of the $47 million it needs to care for 1.3 million children, many of whom are struggling to survive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Recent attacks by rival militant groups have killed scores in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and forced thousands to flee their homes. The surge in violence comes as the region is still grappling with the destruction caused by the eruption of the Mount Nyiragongo volcano in May. The biggest recent attacks have been the work of the ADF, the Allied Democratic Forces, an Islamist force, and the CODECO, or Cooperative Development Group of Congo, an alliance of different groups. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti is in Bunia, the capital of Ituri province, and he spoke today with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the conditions in the area. He starts by saying DRC President Felix Tshisekedi is visiting the region.
President reached Goma since the volcano eruption. He went in Goma last week on the weekend for 2 days, and then he went to Beni. Today he's arriving in Beni, and he will meet also the president of Uganda in the border between DRC and Uganda, and then tomorrow he will come in Bunia. As you know, the North Kivu and Ituri provinces are under state of siege, so the president is visiting to do some evaluation of the state of siege.
Now, tell me what you are seeing there in Bunia and Ituri province in general.
Ituri province has many security problems, and last week there was many attacks. The army was progressing fighting the ADF Islamists. The militia of CODECO attacked in another side, and that made the army to stop a bit attacking the ADF to protect people in the north of Ituri. That's the problem of this part of the city, because CODECO are in the north of Beni and ADF are attacking in the south of Beni. So when the army is attacking, fighting with ADF in the south, also CODECO attack people in the north. So that destabilizes soldiers.
Now, what are you hearing from residents of the area, displaced people, aid agency workers? What are they telling you about conditions in the community for people?
I met today the presidents of IDPs in their camp. They have very bad conditions. They are in a bad situation because just the city of Bunia has exactly 50,000 IDPs families. So in Africa, if we can say each family has 7 people, so it's around 900,000 people living in camps with no food, with no sanitation, and those are the ones who came since long time. But because of the last week attacks in south and north, that make also many people leaving their village and come in Bunia. So the situation is not good.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in Bunia. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson. A suicide bomber has blown himself up at a military training camp in the south of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. 2 security sources told VOA Somali Service that the bomber mingled with aspiring military recruits at the entrance of the camp, then detonated a suicide vest. Army Chief Brigadier General Odawa Yusuf confirmed the deaths of 10 recruits and added that 20 others were injured. The Al-Shabaab military group claimed responsibility for the attack and says 40 soldiers were killed and 50 injured. A South African drug company, Aspen Pharmacare, says it will get the country's and the continent's rollout of Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine back on track within weeks. Millions of J&J jabs that were supposed to have been distributed across Africa will soon be destroyed after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, declared them unsuitable for use. The vaccines were produced in Baltimore by Emergent Biosolutions. The FDA says the company hasn't conformed to required standards, which has resulted in at least one batch of jabs being contaminated with substances from another vaccine. Darren Taylor has more.
Aspen, Africa's biggest drug firm, is packaging vaccines for J&J at its factory in Gqeberha on South Africa's Eastern Cape coast. The jabs are destined for parts of Europe, Canada, South Korea, and mostly Africa. Neither Aspen nor J&J will confirm the exact number of unsuitable vaccines it'll destroy. A senior executive at Aspen has told VOA it's several million. 2 million were originally earmarked for distribution in South Africa alone. In a statement to shareholders yesterday, Aspen CEO Stephen Saad said his company and J&J would ensure these were not lost to the country.
Hopefully we're going to get more, but at least the 2 million doses will be covered, one out of Aspen production and two out of other product that they will bring into South Africa that is unaffected by this contamination. Over the next period of 2 weeks, we will have the couple of million doses plus that we've lost to be able to really speed up our vaccination program.
Scientists say the J&J jab is Africa's best hope of beating COVID-19. It's the only vaccine that doesn't need a second booster injection. It also doesn't need special ultra-cold refrigeration. Saad says his company's been preparing for disruption since April, shortly after the FDA ordered Emergent Biosolutions to close its Baltimore plant.
What J&J decided together with us was we brought in other material that came from a European supplier rather than American supplier, Emergent, who had the problem. And we started making that just about a month ago, and we continued to make those batches. One of those batches come off our line within a week, so before Monday of next week.
This batch, says Saad, will consist of more than 1 million shots. He adds that Aspen's dedicated to helping the whole of Africa overcome what he calls a temporary setback.
I must tell you, our heart is very focused on the continent and to make sure that our other countries in Africa are properly supported. We've got more of this European material that will come off our lines during July, and so it's critical that we look after not only South Africa, but Africa as well.
Saad agrees that South Africa needs special attention. With almost 2 million people infected and almost 58,000 deaths set to rise steeply due to a third wave of the pandemic, it's the African country so far worst affected by COVID-19. Its vaccine rollout has been hampered by setback after setback, and scientists say only 1% of South Africa's required immunizations have happened. Saad says the latest moves by Aspen and J&J will result in this percentage climbing rapidly.
I'm very confident because the stock is sitting there. The stock has a drug substance that's positive, and we have the finished dose form without any material that's come from this facility in America called Emergent. So all in all, I've got a very high degree of confidence about where we are. You never want to say never, but I think that we're in a space now where we've done all we can and we've ticked all the blocks, and it's really about getting the shots into the South African population now.
Many in the healthcare sector are, however, worried that the contamination controversy will scare some people away from being vaccinated, lengthening South Africa's journey toward herd immunity. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The West African nation of the Gambia has deployed its National Guard in the streets to help curb a surge of murder, rape, and armed robberies in the country. Reporter Panderambai has been following the story and reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The armed forces said over the weekend it has deployed the National Guard to help complement police efforts to combat crime amid a rampage by criminals who have been targeting communities and occasionally killing people in cold blood. Major Lamin Sanyang is the spokesman of the Gambia Armed Forces.
Well, the operation is occasioned by the rising state of insecurity, in that there has been a rise in criminal activity in the country. And as such, the Gambia National Guard has been asked to deploy its men to come to the aid of civil authority and also to support the Gambia police force in maintaining public order and public safety.
The police also have launched an operation called Operation Zero Crime that has led to hundreds of arrests in police raids.
We have seen a spate of increase in robberies, armed banditry, murders in and around the country. And as a result, it's important that the government takes a position to restore public order and safety.
The operation has been named Operation Restore Sanity. The army spokesman couldn't tell VOA how many soldiers are taking part in the operation. but he says it is here to stay.
Well, the operation is an ongoing process, so for now I'll not be able to give you the numbers, but it just depends on the scale of the operation itself. So we have for now the number of personnel who are adequate to take care of the situation as it is, but it may increase depending on the circumstances.
The soldiers' redeployment into the streets hasn't gone down well in some sections of the community, likely due to the tainted image of the military under former dictator Jammeh. Spokesman Sanyang again.
But we are here to do a job. Staying in the barracks, doing what? Sleeping? Eating? Is that what they want? And, you know, besides, this is, you know, from an outside from the public itself that they want the armed forces to intervene. But, before bringing the Gambian National Army, we are bringing in the Gambian National Guard, which is one of the services under the Gambian Armed Forces. And it is mandated by the Constitution to be deployed to deal with internal security issues. And this is no exception to that.
The Gambia is battling with massive youth unemployment and the rising cost of living. Drug use and abuse are said to be prevalent among the youth population. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Reuters is reporting that Sudan is now open to a partial interim agreement with Addis Ababa on Ethiopia's multi-billion dollar Grand Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile. Only last week, Sudan and Egypt had agreed to coordinate efforts to push Ethiopia to negotiate seriously on an agreement in filling and operating the massive hydroelectric project. Sudan's latest move marks a potential shift in its position. Egypt, which depends on the Nile for about 97% of its irrigation and drinking water, sees the dam as an existential threat. Ethiopia said it reached its first target of filling the dam last year. It has announced it will proceed next month with the second phase, with or without a deal. The Pan-African Parliament hadn't made much of an impression in its 17 years until a scuffle about who should run the organization underscored divisions instead of the continental unity that it is supposed to foster. Footage of the group's recent meeting in South Africa showed representatives quarreling loudly and trying to snatch ballot boxes from each other. We go to reporter Kuzaza Nawashi to find out more on the matter.
Barbara Rodzi, who represents Zimbabwe at the parliament, explains the banning issue that prompted her to protest.
At the Pan-African Parliament, our major issue is leadership. This parliament was instituted in 2004, and its rules and protocol for AU organs, which Pan-African Parliament falls under, that there should be a cognition and respect for geographical rotation for all regions to be in the leadership. Every 3 years that we have elections.
She says that the institution at its infancy had the East at the helm. Nigeria followed, which was to be followed by the Central region. But Nigeria didn't stay for its entire term. And the Central took over and stayed for its regular stint.
That's when the conversation started. But they maneuvered their way and they took over the seat again after the exchange, which was no problem.
She explains when the problem started.
In 2017, the EU itself, knowing that 2018 was the next year of election, the AU wrote to Pan-African Parliament to say, do not forget you are reminded about geographical rotation in the next election, which was 2018. But Central or the French-speaking countries supported each other and brought back the guy who was there in 2015.
Rodzi blames the group's relative anonymity on the leadership. She says very few people in Africa know about it, even though the parliament was formed to provide representation for African people.
However, if you are talking of unifying Africa or being united as one, there is nothing wrong if you look at it that way. But there is everything that is wrong when the leadership itself is not doing nothing for the institution to be known. I'm sure you've only known about Pan-African Parliament now because of the scuffles that arise. But nobody within the media house knew about Pan-African Parliament, including those in South Africa. Yet this institution has been there for 2004. We have a reason for rotating leadership.
Critics have said there is an irony that Rhodes called for reforms at the Pan-African Parliament. Yet back home, her party, ZANU-PF, has been dragging its feet to implement electoral reforms. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
A new report by the World Bank says Zimbabwe is poised to grow by a little over 3% in 2021 in the aftermath of a two-year recession. Adigando has more from Bulawayo.
According to the World Bank's Zimbabwe Economic Update, the economy is set to expand by 3.1% this year, thanks largely to the agricultural sector's recovery. The current growing season has been punctuated by above normal rainfall, and the harvest is expected to be good this year. The report also notes that the situation will improve as inflation ebbs and businesses adjust to COVID-19 limitations, although the pandemic will continue to impede the economy's ability to produce jobs, reduce poverty, and improve living standards. The bank expects Zimbabwe's gross domestic products to grow further in 2022 to just above 5% as the current vaccination program improves and the government's national development strategy bears fruit. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe's finance ministry says it has recorded a budget surplus in the first quarter of 2021 amounting to 9.8 billion Zimbabwean dollars or US 119 million dollars using the official exchange rate. Local economic analysts view the optimism expressed by both the World Bank and the government cautiously, noting that citizens continue to struggle to make ends meet. Economic analyst Felix Chari weighs in.
There is a general agreement that there is a low demand in the economy. This is accounted for by the fall in labor earnings, especially for civil servants, who contribute a majority of the labor force. To achieve the intended economic growth, there is need to raise salaries as a way of improving demand and expenditure in the economy. Remember, expenditure drives economic growth.
Another economic analyst, Reggie Shoko, highlights the importance of agriculture to economic growth. He says any progress can be reversed by what he says is the government's knack for issuing disruptive directives, such as the so-called SRI statutory instruments, affecting banks and businesses. The most recent one sets rules for businesses that apply for foreign currency, including a measure to ensure that companies use funds obtained on foreign exchange markets for purposes for which they are intended.
But there's still also risks are associated with the current SI 127 that is called cost of volatility in the economy that will increase inflation by its operation, and it might have a serious impact on certain things that have been positive over the few months, which will give a dent to the current positive trajectory that everyone is forecasting in the 2021 into 2022 in the Zimbabwean economy.
Analysts such as Shoko say more needs to be done to provide financing for social services, health and education, given the tensions exacerbated by the global pandemic. But they say the real test for the economy will be when borders are reopened and there's renewed demand for foreign goods and for foreign exchange, among other challenges. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Zambia's former president, Kenneth Kaunda, who is being treated in a military hospital in the capital Lusaka for pneumonia, is reportedly improving. According to the French news agency AFP, the 97-year-old founding father of Zambia was admitted to the hospital yesterday. His administrative assistants told AFP that Kaunda had not contracted the coronavirus and was being treated for simply pneumonia. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.